Yes, sir. Travis repeated the command into the comm with withering assertiveness. She was in her battle zone, the place he'd seen her so many times. She was ready to fight. And so was he. Repulse report shuttle away, 40 seconds until transit. All ships are on the specified heading at full thrust. Baron felt the feral side of him taking control, pushing away the warning signs, even as the intellectual part of his brain screamed about the absurdity of leading three ships forward unsupported. The rest of the fleet would be close behind, of course, and his tiny advance guard would have some surprise on its side. But it was still a wild risk. Fighters, I need to get squadrons into space, assuming they can scramble in time. Atara, scramble. Admiral, I've got Jake Stockton on your line. He reports his fighter drill is underway on all three ships remaining in the system. All squadrons are in the bays and ready for launch. A what? What drill? But even as he spoke the words, understanding dawned. Baron was stunned, although he realized almost immediately that perhaps he shouldn't be. He was violating orders himself, and he'd never known an officer to be as liberal on interpretations of commands as Jake Stockton. Though technically running a drill isn't a violation of anything. And it meant he had over 200 fighters ready to go. He felt a wave of relief, gratitude that he had officers like Stockton serving under him, men and women who thought for themselves, showed initiative. 18 squadrons of bombers would vastly amplify the combat power he had available until the rest of the fleet returned. It wasn't enough force to meaningfully hurt the enemy either, but just maybe it was enough to buy the time he needed until the rest of his ships could return. He turned toward Atara and he said, "All squadrons launch. Their orders are to attack." He took a deep breath and he repeated the command. All squadrons, attack. Hi, Commander Hellarax. We're picking up three ships inbound from the jump point. The force that remained there during the battle has mostly withdrawn, but now the remaining vessels appear to be moving toward our flanking force. The Highborn commander turned, glaring across the control room toward the Thrall officer. That is absurd. What could three of the human vessels possibly hope to accomplish? But even as he spoke, he saw the ships coming on himself, and seconds later small clouds of dots appearing in front of each. His first thought was to turn to face the approaching ships, to destroy them and then come about to engage the enemy's main force even then approaching. But there wasn't time. If he turned, he would sacrifice the advantage of his longer-ranged weapons, and he would give the enemy main fleet time to make a run through his line, to get more ships out of the system. And he was there to ensure the hegemony fleet died where it was. Three ships and whatever cluster of minuscule craft appear to be launching from them cannot possibly be a threat to the flanking force. All ships are to continue as per the existing plan, and to prepare to engage the small enemy force with rear batteries if it continues to close. As you command, Highborn. The Thrall, highly ranked among his slave comrades, bowed no less obsequiously than those of lower positions. Then he returned to his station, snapping out his own orders to the other humans present in the control room. Hellarax turned toward the display, watching himself as the new contacts moved forward, directing his thoughts to the ship's AI, commanding it to modify the scanning protocols. He remained committed to his directive, to interposing his force between the enemy fleet and its escape path. But he was troubled, nevertheless, about the strange behavior of the small group of enemy vessels. He reviewed the scans, analyzed the new information flowing in from the sensor arrays. For an instant he imagined they weren't ships at all, but instead some kind of massive missiles, placed as a trap to move against his ships as they passed by. But the readings all suggested standard vessels similar to the others deployed in the system. If anything, the newer contacts were less advanced, their energy readings weaker than the other ships in the system. He couldn't make any case to himself to alter the plan, to interrupt his fleet's flanking maneuver. If the three ships continued to approach, his fleet had more than enough firepower to destroy them, without deviating from the plan. But what are those smaller contacts? He watched as the clouds moved forward, advancing in front of the ships that had launched them. His first thought had been missiles, but scanner reports confirmed they carried no detectable quantities of antimatter. It was possible they were nuclear warheads of some sort, but he was confident his fleet's defensive batteries could handle them if they approached. His conclusions made sense, and he believed they were correct. But he was still concerned. Then he pulled his attention away. His ships were approaching their appointed positions, and the enemy fleet, now in wholesale retreat, was approaching. It was time to finish them. Time to make the victory complete.
It's been a year, but I know none of you have forgotten the fighting around Colossus. I know what you can do, what you have done, so I won't waste words now. You are the best, the most elite squadrons in the fleet, and by extension, in all of human-occupied space. We're outnumbered here and outgunned, but I've been watching this whole fight, and beyond the handful of hegemony fighters, I haven't seen any other small craft. These bastards have savaged the hegemony fleet, and they're going to do the same to our own ships, unless we do something about it. You've all got full bomber hits and double warhead plasma torpedoes, so make them count. These ships are tough as hell, there's no question about that. But by God, so are we. So follow me once again. Follow me into the fight.
Stockton pulled back on the throttle, feeding power to his engines. He had no idea what kind of point defense to expect, whether the way toward the approaching ships would be wide open, or if one order from the enemy fleet commander would unleash a wave of deadly fire that wiped space clean of his squadrons. He thought about it for a second, and then he put it out of his mind. It didn't matter. There was no choice. His people were going in anyway, and they'd know what they faced soon enough. He stared at his combat display, at the lines of enemy ships ahead of his wings. They hadn't changed their alignment to react to Baron's approaching attack. They probably don't consider three ships a major threat. And that means they haven't seen lightnings, or at least they don't know what a few determined squadrons can do. He felt his blood rising, the heat of battle flowing through his body. He was older, wiser than he'd been years before, and he'd come to appreciate the tragic cost of battle. But deep in his soul, he was still an animal, a predator, a hunter.
We don't know much about these ships, but we fought the hegemony enough and we saw how much trouble they've had here. This is a new enemy, the most powerful one we've ever faced, so we're going to do just what we do best. We're going to take our lightnings in, all the way in, and we're going to plant these torpedoes into the guts of those ships. There's something about them, something that throws off the scanner, so let's see how that works at 1,000 kilometers or 500, or less. Because when I say close, I mean close.
Stockton wasn't even sure what he was asking of his people was possible. But that had never stopped him before, and it damn sure wasn't going to be here, hundreds of light years from home. He didn't know what kind of defenses the enemy had, but he hadn't seen them launch any fighters in the battle, so he was willing to bet his squadrons would come as a surprise to them. 200 bombers weren't a lot, not against the fleet looming ahead. But he had another 800 on the way, and 200 of those were sitting in the bays, courtesy of his staged drill, just as Dauntless's, Repulse's, and Indomitable squadrons had been. He reached down, grabbed the throttle, and he blasted his ship at full thrust, knowing every one of his pilots would follow his lead. He looked again at his screen and then out of the front of the cockpit into the blackness of space. Stockton knew what was happening, where he was leading his pilots. Into another war against a new enemy, one even darker, more powerful than the ones they had faced before. Barely a year of peace and now it was gone, and along with it the hopes of so many of his people. And the lives of the thousands who would almost certainly die in the war his attack was about to start. Even his own thoughts, of time with Stara, of living a life without wondering if each day would be his last, and seeing that same fear in her eyes, they were shattered as well. There was a part of him mourning, despondent over what was happening all around, but mostly he found himself wishing he felt differently than he did, wondering what was wrong with him, what disconnect inside him drove the inexplicable thoughts taking control of him as his ship blasted hard toward the enemy, toward combat. He felt like he was back home.
Chapter 39 Colossus Lyra System Year 322 AC.
You can't be serious, Admiral. Sonya Eaton stared back at Winters with an expression that suggested she was looking at a man with two heads. There must be someone else, someone senior to me, someone better qualified.
No one I trust as much as I do you, Sonya.
Winters stood a meter from the flustered officer. He was telling the truth. He did trust her and she'd proven her abilities again and again. But Winters was trying to make his point without mentioning that the fleet's pool of senior officers had been badly depleted by years of war. That was an unpleasant enough topic under any circumstances, but the last promising member of the High Command to be killed had been her sister. Sarah Eden had been the Navy's rising star, the officer in the group just under Baron and Winters most likely to succeed one day to the top command. But the last war had claimed her, as it had Van Stryker and so many others, and now it fell to her younger sister to fill her shoes.
But, Admiral, The decision's been made, Captain, though it's no longer Fleet Captain Eaton, I'm afraid. Admiral Barron and I discussed this even before he left, and I'm afraid your command of something like Colossus makes it a virtual necessity. Your stars will be delivered to your quarters tomorrow, but for now, you'll have to take my word for it, Commodore Eaton. Winters extended his hand, and a stunned Sony Eaton just stared at it for a good 10 seconds before reaching out and grasping it.
I don't know what to say, Admiral.
Don't say anything. You earned this position, and even more, you earned the trust Admiral Barron and I have in you. This feels like a reward now, but you may feel differently when we're 50 systems coreward, and you're sitting in the middle of the biggest target in the fleet. I only have limited information, but based on what Tyler sent me, this war is going to be nasty, far worse than any we've fought before, if you can wrap your head around that. We're going to need the best every one of us has to give, and not all of us are going to make it back, if any of us do. And you'll be commanding the one ship we don't really know how to operate, so hold back the thanks, at least for now. You'll have Anya Fritz and the team the Hegemony sent out to offer technical support, but you're still going to have one hell of a job on your hands.
I'll do everything I can, Admiral. I won't let you down.
I know you won't, and so does Admiral Barron. That's why you got this command. Just do your best. It's all any of us has to offer.
Yes, Admiral, I will.
Winters nodded, and then he managed to smile. A skinny, haunting sort of grin. 1 year of peace, Sonya. 1 year. We've barely licked our wounds, and we're not even close to replacing our losses. And it looks like another war has found us. Another enemy. One we know almost nothing about.
That's okay, Admiral. We'll do what we have to do, as we've always done.
There was defiance in her tone. Strength. But Winters knew it was almost certainly fake. As fake as his own.
I just wanted to tell you, we're all proud to have you in command, Commodore. We couldn't have a more worthy officer in charge, especially with us heading coreward and possibly into battle.
Anya Fritz stood in front of Eaton, and her words dripped with sincerity, even though the engineer was also a Commodore, and one whose commission bore the earlier date. Fritz technically outranked Eaton, at least when they were off Colossus. But the sparkly new Commodore held the ship command, and with it, domain over everyone on board. The official status of such an interpretation was a fact of no particular significance, however. Anya Fritz's rank was symbolic of her status, of all she'd done. But it was largely superfluous. The engineer had never expressed the slightest interest in commanding anything except her teams of sweating technicians.
Thank you, Commodore Fritz. I'm hoping you can bring me up to speed on developments on board. From what I've heard, you've made considerable progress.
Eaton could see the power in Fritz's expression, the strength in her posture. The engineer almost radiated an aura of pure determination. Eaton knew Fritz was unlikely to do anything besides work her magic to keep Colossus operating, and Eaton was grateful for that fact. But if Fritz ever stepped out of her bounds as head of the engineering team, Eaton doubted she could face down the legendary officer. Eaton was tough herself, one who'd served alongside some of the Confederation's very best, but Anya Fritz was a force of nature. Eaton was grateful they were on the same side, and there was no one in the Confederation she'd rather have crawling around the almost endless guts of the massive warship, conflicting ranks or not.
We have made progress, Commodore Eaton.
A pause and a sour look on Fritz's face.
The Hegemony team has been of considerable assistance.
Eaton didn't imagine the sentence she just uttered was the most difficult thing Fritz had ever done, but it sounded very much like it was close.
That is not surprising, Anya. Who even knows how many years they spent restoring it, and the newer tech in it is theirs, not ours. I have no doubt you'd have managed everything yourself, but right now we need every shortcut we can get. Admiral Winters is already out at Danith with a fleet, and we've got to follow as quickly as possible. I think our fleet is going to need everything it can get to win this fight.
Or even to survive it.
I think you're right, Sonya, and there's no question. Colossus is the strongest thing we've got. The strongest thing the Hegemony's got, too.
A pause.
With any luck, we'll be able to set out for the Badlands in a month, maybe a bit sooner.
Eaton had been hoping to get started more quickly, but she realized that had never been realistic. She just nodded. Fritz stood quietly for a moment, and then she said,
It did help having the Hegemony team here, but we're going to need even more from them. If Colossus is going to fight a war for us, Admiral Barron's going to have to get more from our new allies than a few engineers. We can fly out there on fusion power, but when this thing goes into battle, we're going to start burning through antimatter. And if we don't want to turn this massive warship into a toothless floating hull, the Hegemony is going to have to give us more.
Fritz was silent for a moment before she continued.
A lot more.
The fleet will move out at once, Commander. All ships full thrust to the number 2 transit point.
Winter sat in Victory's command chair, looking out over the flagship staff. The battleship was the newest in the fleet, the largest and most powerful vessel ever launched from a Confederation shipyard. It was also one of the small number of active ships that was not a veteran of the recent war. Her launch had been barely 3 months before, and her workstations and corridors were still almost blindingly new and bright. The ship had enhanced primaries built into her hull from scratch, weapons considerably more powerful than the patch jobs that had been crammed into the fleet's existing line ships. She carried an extra reactor as well, a triple fusion unit larger than anything the Confederation had built before in a movable hull, and a resource that cut a full 30 seconds from the recharge time of her main batteries. She was the best in the fleet, save, of course, for Colossus, and the natural choice for a flagship. Winters hadn't really thought twice about using her as such, though he'd thought for a passing moment that he would turn the ship over to Baron when the fleet linked up with the Admiral's advance force. Then he realized, with a bit of a grin, he probably couldn't pry Baron out of Dauntless with a crowbar. And she's not even the real Dauntless, at least not as far as he sees it. Winters was still a little surprised the Senate had approved a new war, that they had sent him coreward with broad new powers for Baron. That had all been Andy, of course, and he couldn't help but be relieved, and amused at how thoroughly she'd outpaced both him and Gary Holston in efficiency. Winters had been ready to engage in outright mutiny, even to send Marines into the Senate chambers to force a vote at gunpoint, and he could only imagine the threats and blackmail that had spawned from Gary Holston's dirty little collection of files. But in the end, it had only taken one pregnant woman with the audacity to address the entire Confederation, to rouse the people behind one of their own, one of the few revered as a genuine hero on every planet in every system. Tyler Baron had inherited a beloved old name, and his own actions had only polished it further. Andy had recognized that, and she'd gone to the people, not as one of the most dangerous women alive, not as the warrior who'd killed Ricard Liet, but looking sad and desperate, asking for the men and women of the Confederation to rise up behind their hero, to leave the Senate no choice, no room for dirty political wrangling. And she'd made sure the camera angles left no doubt she was carrying Tyler's child. Winters imagined the general consensus was that Andy had been lucky to marry into a dynasty like the Barons. She'd come from nothing, less than nothing, and most of her career had been disreputable to a certain extent at least, and obscured in the shadows. But Clint Winters knew the more complex truth. Tyler Baron was pretty damned lucky too, and Winters himself was fortunate to have them both as his friends. He sat quietly and thought about Andy, stuck home out of the action for once, probably for the first time in her life. For all the dangers she'd faced, all the enemies she'd fought, he knew this would be her greatest challenge in many ways. There wasn't much he could do about any of that, about the deadly dangers all his people faced, or the frustrations Andy would have to endure. But he promised himself one thing. He would make sure Baron survived the war, see that he made it back to his wife, to the child he didn't even know was on the way. He would do that whatever it took. Somehow. Whatever the cost to him. Chapter 40 CFS Dauntless, Atara Mordlin System, Year 322 AC. The Battle of Pharsalon, to forge an alliance. Baron stared straight ahead, trying to decide who was crazier, him or Jake Stockton. He was leading three battleships in a reckless charge against a whole enemy fleet. But Stockton was out in front, taking just over 200 bombers into the teeth of that same fleet, with no idea whatsoever what kind of defenses the enemy had against small craft. The only excuse either of them had was that they were well positioned to take the enemy ships from the rear. It was an advantage, but a fleeting one, and if Baron waited for the rest of the fleet to transit back, it would be lost. Besides, the best he could figure, the rest of his ships would reach engagement range just about the same time as Kronos's retreating forces did on the other end. Atara and Dauntless's AI agreed with his calculations as well. Without help, the Hegemony fleet would be torn apart, hit from two directions as they fled, and the only thing he could do to mitigate that was throw what he did have into the fight. Immediately. He slid around in his seat, his shirt matted to his back by sweat. It had only been a year since he'd been in battle, and he'd spent the last several months planning and expecting a fight. But now that it had come, he felt rusty, a little uncomfortable. How much of that was normal nerves before a battle,
and how much concern over the consequences of his completely unauthorized and illegal actions, he had no idea.
Admiral, Conqueror and Endeavor have just transited.
Baron felt himself exhaling, a bit harder than normal. He hadn't really doubted his fleet would return when they received the orders, though every command officer in the force was effectively abetting treason, but it was still reassuring to see they begin to appear. Still, Atara's report and the reality it represented didn't change the calculus for the next 20 minutes or so. The returning vessels were well behind his tiny vanguard, and the ships had low intrinsic velocities as they came through. But it still gave him a boost, and he suspected it was good for morale all around.
That's good to hear, Admiral Travis. This may be extraneous, but advise the new arrivals they are to proceed after us at full thrust and to gauge the enemy the instant they are in range, and I want full evasive protocols in effect. Those enemy weapons are no damn joke, and they'll open up long before we get into range.
Baron wanted to believe his ships would come up from behind and avoid any heavy enemy fire until their own primaries were in range. But he couldn't count on it. The enemy would still focus mostly on the far larger hegemony fleet. But he knew he would order a few ships to spin around and fire at the new attackers coming in if he was in their place, and he wasn't going to bet the enemy commander would do anything different.
Yes, Admiral.
An instant later, Baron added, advise Captain Devers on Conqueror. She is to pass these orders on to the other ships as they arrive. That would save some time, a little at least. Conqueror was 20 light seconds closer to the transit point than Dauntless and her two companions. Not a big time savings, but Baron knew every second counted. Besides, he suspected he and Atara were going to get very busy very soon.
Yes, sir.
A few seconds later.
Done.
Baron looked back at the display, watching as Stockton's squadrons closed. They were well within point defense range, at least what had been point defense range when facing hegemony ships, but they hadn't been fired upon. Yet.
Baron let himself hope the enemy was baffled by his strike craft, that their immensely powerful ships were devoid of the precise weaponry needed to face bomber attacks. It turned out he was partially right.
Commander, scanners show 3 of the Confederation vessels moving on the enemy flanking force. They appear to have launched bombers and the strike force is moving into attack range.
Kronos heard the words and he felt a strange mix of hope and confusion.
He'd hoped Baron would find some way to intervene in the battle. But then he'd realized it didn't really matter. The Confederation ships Baron commanded weren't enough to turn the tide anyway. Part of Kronos still wanted whatever help he could get, but he also cheered Baron's escape. It would serve little purpose, perhaps, save to allow the Confederation commander to die somewhere else some other day. Kronos knew any hope of defeating the others would die with his fleet, but he knew enough about Tyler Baron to bet he'd give the enemy a few surprises before he went down. But now Baron was attacking with the last 3 of his ships that hadn't transited. That made no sense, none at all. Not until Kronos saw the first 2 confed hulls emerge from the tube.
He's bringing his ships back. He really is attacking.
He was confused at first. He'd given up hope that Baron would violate his orders, throw his ships into the hopeless fight. But then he understood. Baron was hitting the flanking force, coming at them from behind.
He's outflanking the flanking force.
It made perfect sense. The enemy had been about to catch his fleet between 2 forces, but now their own flanking force was about to be hit from 2 sides.
Kronos stared for a moment, his mind racing, analyses flying wildly around in his thoughts.
The enemy was tough, and they had enough strength in the system to crush both the hegemony and Confederation forces.
But if we hit that flanking force hard enough, we just might do some real damage and then get through the tube.
Live to fight another day.
All ships maintain full thrust. All targeting routines at maximum power. Ignore the ships on our tail. We're going to hit that force ahead of us, while the confeds take them from behind.
He felt a burst of energy, and an excitement that reinvigorated him, drove away the defeat that had lain on him like lead.
All ships acknowledge, Commander, except for Megaron Ilias's force. They are 2 late minutes behind us, and we are still awaiting a reply.
That was 2 minutes until Ilias got the command and more than an hour before his battered force could reach the tube.
Kronos had planned to rip through the enemy flanking force, make a dead run to escape the system. But if he did that, Ilias and his people were as good as dead.
Abandoning Ilias and his ships probably made sense, despite the cost.
Kronos' forces would remain a fleet in being. They would keep the war going.
He knew his younger self would have pressed forward in an instant, gone with what the numbers in the cold analysis told him, despite the fact that Ilias was his friend. But 6 years of war in the Rim had changed him. Fighting against Tyler Baron and his warriors had changed him. He wasn't going to leave his friend and thousands upon thousands of Kriegri behind, not without at least trying to buy them the time they needed. "I want all rail guns double-loaded, and I want all secondary batteries online and firing as they come into range. We're going in, and we're going to blast that flanking force to radioactive scrap." Stockton's fingers tightened and his ship lurched hard, loosing its payload toward the enemy ship right in front of him. He'd improvised on the way in, changed his tactics on the fly. He decelerated hard as he approached the enemy ship, something that seemed completely unnatural. But there hadn't been a choice. He wasn't able to get a solid target lock beyond 1,000 kilometers. And he wasn't able to get a really solid fix outside 500. He let himself hope for a few brief moments that his bombers would be free from defensive fire as they approached. But that had been too much to hope for. The enemy batteries had opened up far closer in than he'd initially feared, and the weapons firing were cumbersome, clearly not designed for anti-fighter operations. But they were deadly when they hit, and he'd lost over 30 of his ships since the batteries had opened up. And that number was almost certain to rise as his squadron slowed almost to a standstill to deliver their torpedoes from a range so short he didn't know what to call it. Point blank and other terms of the sort had long applied to vastly larger distances. The concept of a bomber coming in less than 500 kilometers was something new, something he just made up. At normal attack speeds, that was less than a fifth of a second of the target ship, far too little time for an assaulting ship to pull away in time. His ships had to decelerate hard and come into knife-fighting range. It was the only way they could get effective targeting. They'll probably call it the Stockton maneuver. The thought of it made him sick to his stomach. He watched his torpedo moving toward the enemy vessel. It was strange as well to see a warhead moving so slowly, but it had gone out with the intrinsic velocity of his almost stationary fighter. He hesitated for a few seconds, scolding himself for it, as he pulled hard on the throttle and maxed out his engines. "You got lucky there, Raptor. Someone was asleep at the switch. You were a sitting duck waiting to see if that torpedo hit." He felt the G-forces slamming into him, pressing him back into his acceleration couch. His ship began to move forward, and even as it did, he swung the throttle around, pulling away in as wild and evasive pattern as he could manage. He realized he was holding his breath, waiting for the fatal shot to come in. But it didn't, and as he sailed back past the target ship, he saw his torpedo slamming into the hull. He didn't know how much damage, if any, he'd done, and he wouldn't have even had confirmation of the hit if he'd been quicker to make good his escape. "We're going to need some way to get decent scans and damage assessments. Maybe a small probe or something to launch with the torpedo." That was an issue, a problem that needed to be solved, but not just then. Stockton had to get his people out after their runs and get them back to base to rearm. And he had to organize the squadrons he knew would be coming in next. First a mirror image of the initial one, the wings from the other three ships that had run the fake drills. And after that, the squadrons from the rest of the fleet, 600 more ships, hopefully benefiting from what he'd learned so far on the first attack. He looked down and winced as he saw that 20 more of his ships were gone, pilots who'd been less lucky than he was, who'd gotten blasted as they slowed to a crawl to commence their own attacks. The feel of battle against the others was entirely different than it had been against the hegemony, but Stockton knew then and there with a sickening certainty the fights ahead would be no less costly than those of the last war. "All squadrons back to base, refuel and rearm." But even as he gave the commands, he doubted there would be time for a second sortie. The mission was to get as much as possible of the hegemony fleet out of the system, and then to run. To run as quickly as possible, and then to regroup. And to try to figure a way, any way, to stop the enemy next time. "All ships full thrust. Divert power from weapons if necessary, but I want those engines at maximum output." Ilias hated running. It wasn't something he'd had to do very often, and he was finding the role as the underdog decidedly irritating. His first urge was to stay and fight, to fire his weapons with every last watt of power, to win where he was, or to die. The problem with that plan was a simple one. The odds of dying in such a scenario were close to 100%. His ships were outmatched, and with Kronos's command heading toward the transit tube at maximum thrust, they were badly outnumbered too. He was running for a simple reason. It was the only way to survive.
the only chance to save even a portion of the hegemony combat power he commanded. The scene was a nightmare, the darkness of defeat coming down on him, the cold breath of death heavy on his neck. Ilias had overcome the fear he'd felt earlier, the vague and general panic at facing so mysterious an enemy. He'd regained control, and the fear sitting in his gut now was more familiar, if it was also more severe than it had ever been. He was prepared to die if that was his fate, but he couldn't lie to himself, couldn't ignore the fact that he was afraid. He waved his hands at the various acknowledgements. His ships had all received the order. They would all feed what power they had into their engines. About half of his remaining force was still firing at least some of their weapons, but with every passing moment, every enemy hit, another ship's guns went silent. How many had sufficient engines and reactor power to make a good run at escaping was a guess. Ilias leaned back, feeling the pressure as the G-forces generated by Anthocles's massive thrust overwhelmed the dampeners. His ship had suffered damage in the battle, but Providence had spared her engines and enough of her power generation to allow her to blast away at full thrust. That gave the ship a chance, at least, to make it to the tube. But it was still a long way. The massive velocity of Ilias's approach had plunged his ships deeper into the system than any other hegemony forces, and that meant their route back out was just as long. He doubted any of his people would have made it out, but the intensity of Cronus's attack on the enemy flanking force, coupled with the apparent return of Tyler Baron's Confederation fleet, had distracted the enemy. Almost half the ships that had been bearing down on his battered and limping force had been diverted, sent to engage Cronus's ship before the enemy flanking force was overrun. It was a welcome respite, though one he knew his comrades would pay for as the diverted ships closed on Cronus's command from yet another direction. He turned to issue a new series of orders, but he never managed to get them out. Anthocles suddenly shook hard and the flagship spun wildly out of control. All around the bridge, and no doubt everywhere else on the ship, whole series of internal explosions erupted, one system's destruction setting off that of the next in showers of sparks and billowing eruptions of black and gray smoke. The bridge filled quickly with caustic fumes, and Ilias found himself choking and gasping for air along with his officers. Then an entire section of the ceiling and the support superstructure collapsed, burying half the bridge crew and the fleet's second in command under tons of metal and debris. Ilias lay on the deck, feeling the pain of his broken body, gasping for a lungful of what passed for air on that tortured bridge, even as he wondered if his vessel had been mortally wounded. If any of his ships would make it out, he didn't reach a conclusion. Then everything went black. Chapter 41 CFS Dauntless Atara Mordlin System, Year 322 AC The Battle of Pharsalon. Carry on the fight. All ships commence deceleration now. All primary batteries maintain maximum fire. Baron's hands gripped the armrests tightly, sliding a bit on the sweat-covered leather. It was an affectation that had remained with him in battle, from his first desperate fight with the Alliance battleship Invictus, through all the wars he'd fought. It was harmless enough, though he could never explain exactly why he did it. Yes, Admiral, all units acknowledge. Deceleration full, primaries maintain fire. Even as Atara spoke, Dauntless's bridge lights flickered slightly, a sign the main guns had fired. Baron remembered when firing primaries knocked out almost all power to the rest of a ship for 3, 4, 5 seconds. Confederation reactors, and even more crucially, power transmission systems, had advanced rapidly during the wars. For a brief few months, there had been no detectable signs of a ship's primaries firing, but then the enhanced guns were installed in the fleet's battleships, and the increased power drain caused the slightest return to the old dimming. Baron watched as the particle accelerator beams lashed out, slicing through space toward their targets. Dauntless's four shots all missed, the closest of the beams coming within 2,000 kilometers of the target. His ships had all been upgraded with what was being called the Avia system, the advanced targeting routines Baron's stubbornness had extracted from his would-be hegemony allies. But even with the Sigma-9 detection procedure, it was damn hard to hit the enemy's ships. Dauntless had scored a single hit on the battleship's first shot, but that early luck had not repeated itself. Repulse and Indomitable had also scored a single hit each. That wasn't good enough. It wasn't going to get the job done, not unless the rest of the fleet got into range damned quickly. Baron had sent multiple communiques urging the approaching units to push their engines to the max, and they'd responded by wildly abusing their power systems. Two ships,
A battleship and a cruiser had blown out their thrusters entirely. Baron had no idea if the damage was bad or if the vessels had just ruptured a power line or something easily repairable. The answer to that question would determine if those vessels escaped with the fleet, or if 1,500 of his spacers were already effectively walking dead. Baron was about to issue another order, or at least he was going to urge his gunners to focus harder, to do better. But before a word escaped his lips, he saw a flash on the display. Indomitable was gone. The battleship had taken a hit as the three ships approached the enemy line, a grazing shot, one that had inflicted significant but not critical damage. But the fatal shot had been dead on, a direct hit amidships, one that split the great vessel open and tore its containment apart before its reactors could scrag. The explosion was cataclysmic, almost as though a small star had been born, and had lived a lifespan of perhaps 30 seconds before dissipating. There was nothing material left of the battleship. No matter at all larger than scattered atoms. Only a cloud of hard and dense radiation, where one of the greatest ships of the Confederation had been, with its 1,100 crew. 1,123, Baron's mind recalled with unpleasant clarity. He slapped his hand down on the comm unit, pulling up the direct line to Dauntless's gunners. He had no place directing a single ship's operations, though for a few moments more his entire effective command consisted of only two vessels. "Listen to me, all of you. This is Admiral Baron. We need to draw some blood. I know those things are hard to hit, but you have to make this hegemony targeting system work. You have to give me what you've given me so many times before." Baron knew that wasn't entirely accurate, of course. A lot of spacers had been through the crew rosters of the two Dauntlesses. He tended to think of them as all one group, even though he knew that was inaccurate. His normally complete recollection of such details eluded him, though, and he had no idea how many of the gunners down there were veterans of the Hegemony War, and how many were fresh transferees from the brief peacetime restructurings. He didn't even know if there was anyone in gunnery who'd served on the old Dauntless in the Union War, or even earlier in the fight with Invictus, when his beloved ship had faced the Alliance flagship out on the far rim. But he didn't care. If they were on Dauntless now, they were members of that family, and he expected them to act that way. And that meant finding a way to hit those enemy ships. "And increase the power flow on all weapons. Knock it up to 130. That wasn't aggressive. It was straight out reckless. But the situation was already desperate. "And make your shots count." "Yes, Admiral." The gunnery officer's response was shaky, edgy. Baron wasn't sure if the man was more scared of the enemy or of him. He tried not to misuse the weight his name and record placed on his words, usually at least. But just then he was willing to employ any manipulation to get what he needed from his people. He watched as another shot went wide, and then as Repulse fired a few seconds later and scored a hit. Baron clenched his fist in satisfaction, but part of him was disappointed Dauntless hadn't connected first. But his flagship, the namesake of his beloved old command, didn't let him down. 2 minutes later, the recharged primaries fired again, and three of the four shots struck a damaged enemy ship just ahead. One of the hits cut a long gash in the outer hull, but the other two struck the vessel dead center. The ship hovered in space for a few seconds as Baron and every officer on Dauntless's bridge watched in tense anticipation. Then a cheer went up as the enemy vessel exploded in the fury of matter-antimatter annihilation. His people had drawn blood, and even as he watched and listened to his people celebrating, the volume rose to almost deafening levels. The first line of the approaching fleet had moved into position, and almost as one, 30 Confederation battleships opened fire. "Commander Kronos, the Confederation fleet is fully engaged. They caught the enemy flanking force from behind. The others have begun to adjust their facings, and they're heavily engaging Admiral Baron's ships now. But the Confeds took out three of the other ships, and they did heavy damage to five more." Kronos listened to the report, feeling a strange sense of relief that for once he wasn't on the receiving end of Tyler Baron's fury. The Confed ships were outmatched, of course, but at least they had the transit tube just to their rear. His own ships were under fire from behind now, the main enemy fleet closing hard, even as his force continued its fight against the flanking formation ahead of it. As they tried to buy time for Ilias's ships to escape. At least some of them. Kronos hadn't been able to contact his friend. Anthocles had been badly hit, though through some miracle the flagship had managed to maintain a reasonable amount of its thrust capacity, but repeated communiques to its bridge had gone unanswered. Kronos wanted to hold his position, to give Ilias's people more time. But he knew he couldn't.
He and Baron had bracketed the flanking force between them and inflicted considerable damage, but now his own ships faced the same treatment. He could make a run for it, dashing through the battered and disordered enemy task force that had intended to bar his route, but he had to do it without any delay. Every second lost brought the mass of the enemy fleet closer to the rear of his shattered formation. He looked over at the display. Ilias's ships were coming on hard, most of them at least. There were a few lagging behind, vessels with damaged engines or compromised power generation. Kronos wanted to help them, but he knew there was nothing he could do. Every master, every Kriegeri on the ships that couldn't keep up was going to die. As more than 1 billion of our people have already. Gilleron, we're out of time. Commander Ilias's forces will have to follow us the best they can. He'd have felt better if he'd been able to reach Ilias, but it really didn't matter. He couldn't sacrifice the hegemony's ability to fight on, not even in a direct exchange for his friend's life. All ships, full thrust forward, directly toward the Confeds on the other side, and the transit tube beyond. Go, 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 all of you! Full deceleration as you approach. I don't want anybody firing from outside 500 kilometers, so make sure you slow down enough to maneuver inside the envelope. Stockton had led his second strike in, just over 200 bombers, the same as he had the first wave. Now he had 600 coming in, every remaining fighter the ships of the fleet carried. There were rookies in there, mixed with veterans, and a few real aces in the mix. But they were all facing something new, a different enemy and different tactics to engage that foe. They were learning as they went, and he was directing them, leading them, even though he had only an hour's more experience at it than they did. But he was Jake Stockton, and as uncomfortable as it made him to acknowledge the effect that had on his pilots, the reality was undeniable and useful. He could get more from the squadrons than anyone, and young pilots would die for him almost without hesitation. It was a heavy burden, one he knew he'd carry to his grave. But that didn't matter just then. He needed those pilots to fight for him, to do as he said. To die for him. He watched as 8 Lightnings, all that remained of a squadron, moved in on an enemy ship, blasting their engines at overload levels, decelerating until they came almost to a halt in front of their target. The 2 closest were less than 300 kilometers away, and all were inside the 500-kilometer zone. 2 of them disappeared almost immediately, but the other 6 managed to get their torpedoes off. The weapons moved toward the enemy ship, their engines burning furiously, accelerating them from the almost zero intrinsic velocity they'd launched with. The enemy defensive fire took out 2 of them, but the other 4 slammed into the target in rapid succession. It was almost impossible to miss at such close range. Baron's eyes darted back to the fighters, now only 3, and then he watched as another vanished. He could imagine the frantic efforts as the last 2 pilots scrambled to blast their engines to build up enough velocity to conduct some sort of evasive maneuvers. And the fear. He imagined what those pilots were feeling, the last of 12 as they were, racing against time, against an enemy they didn't understand. Stockton was transfixed for a moment, hoping against hope they would make it. But he knew they were dead, even before the 2 sharp spears of energy finished them both, no more than 10 seconds before the containment failed in their target ship, and that vessel disappeared in a blowing cloud of titanic fury. Stockton mourned his lost pilots, a whole squadron wiped out, but one thing really hung there for him like a dark cloud. They didn't live long enough to realize they'd taken out their target. That seemed like a small enough mercy, and yet one his lost pilots had been denied. It was the kind of thing only one of his pilots could fully understand. All ships with damage to drive or power systems are to transit immediately at maximum possible speed, and all escorts. The smaller ships existed to protect their larger cousins, but against the approaching enemy battle line, the cruisers and smaller vessels had nothing to offer, save for more dead spacers if they stayed. Fully operable battleships are to remain in position and prepare to receive returning bomber squadrons. Baron knew they were running out of time, but there was no way he was abandoning Stockton's fighters. The bomber wings had done their share, more than their share, yet again, and Baron was confident he could get them landed and make good his escape. At least something close to confident. Most of Kronos' ships had gone through the point already, and the survivors from Ilias's battered task force were going through now. Kronos had argued with Baron, insisting the Confederation ships transit first, but the hegemony forces were the harder hit by far, and Baron's were in the best position. The Confed admiral had held his ground, and Kronos had finally yielded and sent his people through.
But Leonidor remained, attaching itself to the Confederation line with the Hegemony's supreme military commander at the helm.
We'll make one of us out of him one of these days.
Lingering resentment clashed with newfound respect, but Baron was at least confident that he and most of his people could find the way forward, the way to stand beside their old enemies and face the new threat that endangered them all. The Senate presented a worse problem than an old enemy-turned-ally.
Admiral Stockton reports his lead squadrons will enter final approach range in 2 minutes, Admiral.
Tell him his ships are to land anywhere they can reach, and all battleships are to make their run through the point as soon as their bays are full.
Yes, Admiral.
Baer knew the landing would be a terrible, confused mess, but he also knew Stockton would make it work. They could reorder the squadrons later, get the fighters back to their own motherships. All he cared about at that moment was getting his people out of there the fastest way possible.
He felt satisfaction growing inside him, a warm glow at what his people had achieved, but he pushed back hard against it. They weren't out yet, and even if his forces made good their escape, they had paid a heavy price for their intervention. They'd saved Cronus's fleet, what was left of it anyway, but they'd lost more than 20% of their number and even more of their bombers. And that didn't even take into account the fact that Baron was much more likely to face a trial and imprisonment than a victory parade. But at that moment there was nothing in the universe that mattered, nothing save his spacers. The Senate could order him shot when he got out, but until then he would do everything possible to bring out as many of the people who'd followed him in as he possibly could. He watched as Stockton's lead units approached the waiting battleships. The formation was a disordered wreck, but the strike force commander was somehow keeping it all just enough in line, directing groups of fighters to waiting motherships and nursing his wounded birds in, too. Baron couldn't understand how Stockton had any fuel left. He'd launched with the first strike, and both those ships and the entire second wave had already landed. But no one knew how to fly that ship like Jake Stockton did. He'd land it, even if he was down to his last watt of power when he did it. Baron saw a cluster of fighters heading toward Dauntless, bound for the flagship's waiting bays. He figured it would take another 10 minutes, maybe 12, to get all the squadrons safely aboard, and 14 or 15 before the rest of the enemy force got close enough to open fire. That was close, but it wouldn't be the first time he'd survived by a margin of 2 or 3 minutes. Baron's and Cronus' ships had battered the enemy flanking force, inflicting heavy losses and forcing at least part of the line to pull back. There were 16 of the deadly vessels still in position, and they continued to fire away at the retreating Confeds, a fact Baron recalled sharply as ardent, and the 41 fighters that had landed in her bays, blinked off the display, one more casualty near the end of a bloody day. Another few shots ripped by close to his ships, but he trained his people well. Conducting evasive maneuvers while launching or recovering fighters was an impossibly difficult maneuver, probably something out of reach to any team that didn't have Baron in the command chair and Jake Stockton herding the squadrons in. Baron watched as the last of the wings flew into the bays, and then as Stockton himself came into Dauntless's bay, the last to land. Then he snapped out the order. All remaining ships maximum thrust for the transit point, and advise Commander Cronus that it's time to get the hell out of here.
Chapter 42. Planet Calphoron. Sigma Nordlin 4. Year of Renewal 267, 322 AC.
I know Cronus has thanked you, Admiral Baron, multiple times, I suspect, but now it is for me to do the same, to offer my sincere gratitude, both personally and as number one of the Council, on behalf of the entire Hegemony.
Akela stood in front of Baron, wearing the strange robe and pants combination that seemed to be the Hegemony's incarnation of formal civilian dress. He nodded and he said, "Thank you, Akela. Perhaps you will send an affidavit to the Senate on my behalf, requesting leniency at my court-martial." He smiled thinly as he spoke the words. He'd meant it as a joke, but it had come out sounding serious. The truth was he didn't think anything Akela said would make a difference. He fully expected the Senate to crucify him. But he didn't care. He was sure he'd done the right thing, and he knew he'd do the same thing again if he had the chance. And against the losses his people had suffered, 27,544 casualties at last count, over 17,000 of them killed, he found it hard to care what the pompous fools on Megara did to him. What was a cell somewhere compared to the sacrifices his spacers had made? The only thing that really tugged at him was leaving Andy behind. Had he married her so she could live in loneliness while he spent the rest of his life in the stockade? He wished he could let her go,
convince her to leave him, to start a new life somewhere else, with someone else, if that was what she wanted. But he knew her too well. She was even more stubborn than he was, and she would never leave his side, even if she could only remain there in a figurative sense while he rotted away in some cell. He looked over to Kella, though, and through his own pain and uncertainty, he remembered an enemy-turned-ally, one he could imagine one day calling friend. If he survived. Ilias. Have you? He's still alive, but that's about all I know. It's all anybody knows. The med teams have been working around the clock, but the only thing they've managed to come up with is that they're shocked he's still alive. A pause as Akella looked down sadly. Kronos is there now. The two are very close. Baron felt the urge to go himself, but he held back. The Confederation and the Hegemony had fought alongside each other, once in the closing moments of the battle. Baron knew they were tied together, that each owed any hope of survival to the other's aid and cooperation. But human beings were fragile and flawed creatures, and old hatreds died hard. He'd learned to work with Kronos and the Hegemony commanders, to fight with them. But he imagined how he would feel if Atara lay in a hospital bed near death, if he would welcome Kronos in that stressful and painful moment. No, not yet. I will wait, give them time. If this alliance is going to work, we need to learn to respect each other, to recognize the strengths of the other as well as the weaknesses. Any word on the enemy fleet? That's one bit of good news, or what passes for good news these days, amid a storm of bad news. They seem to have paused. The few scout ships we've managed to get in and out have collected some data. The others inflicted far more damage than they sustained, of course, a loss ratio we cannot possibly sustain. But it appears our combined forces inflicted enough damage to delay the enemy offensive. Whether they've paused to make repairs, or whether the fight in Atara Mordlin drained their supplies more quickly than they expected, or most likely both, we have gained a respite, probably a brief one. That is certainly good news. It was by all military standards, but Baron knew if enough time passed, word would reach Megara of what he'd done, and the Senate would send orders relieving him, demanding he return at once to be tried. He didn't know how he'd handle that when it happened. He'd probably ignore it if it came on some courier boat without the force to impose the Senate's will on him. After all, how much worse could it get than treason? But if the Senate sent a fleet, could he expect the spacers with him to resist, to fight their comrades? Or would he try to subvert whoever was sent for him? He didn't know, and he was sure he wouldn't know, not until the situation was upon him. You said bad news, Akella. Yes, well, aside from the entire situation, of course. This is likely something you would have noticed immediately if you knew our stellar geography better. But there are no highly defensible systems between Atara Mordlin and here. No good place to mount another effort to stop the enemy fleet. Baron stared back at her, feeling a coldness as he grasped where she was going. So the next battle will be here. She paused. That is right, Tyler Baron. In all likelihood, our next chance to stop the enemy, and very likely our last chance, will be right here, at Calphoron.
Come on, old friend, you made it this far. No one on the medical staff can explain how you did. What's the point of surviving all the way back here just to die in the hospital? Besides, I'm going to need you. I can't win this fight alone.
Kronos sat next to the pod, holding Ilias's almost lifeless body. Somehow Anthocles had made it out of Atara Mordlin and all the way back to Calphoron, despite damage that had seemed desperately critical. And inside the monitor's broken and battered hull, Ilias, the second in command of the fleet, lay in a deep coma, clinging somehow, even less explicably, to his own life. Fewer than half of Ilias's ships had made it out of Atara Mordlin, and for all Kronos told himself, the Hegemony fleet remained a battle-worthy force between the lost ships and dozens of badly damaged hulls in need of repairs. He wasn't really sure. Tyler Baron was a welcome addition, though it still remained to be seen how much Confederation power he could deliver. Kronos couldn't imagine the Rim Dwellers turning on their great hero, ignoring his warnings. But then he was often shocked and appalled at some of the petty nonsense that dominated the council proceedings, and by all accounts the Confederation Senate was worse. Kronos had survived his first battle against the others, and he had learned a great deal about the enemy. Some of that was useful, and he was beginning to understand how to fight them. But more of it simply sapped his strength and filled him with a dread that told him his people were doomed, that they could never win the fight that lay ahead. He was ready to do whatever was necessary. He would scrape up every ship in the Hegemony, every vessel stationed somewhere, anywhere,
and he would bring that strength to the capital. When the others came, he would be ready as he could be. And just maybe, he'd have Confederation reinforcements at his side. Tyler Barron at his side.
Victory, this is Dauntless. Do you read?
Barron listened to the comm officer repeating the communique, reaching out to the flagship of the enormous Confederation fleet still emerging from the transit point. Barron had been surprised when the hegemony scout ships had reported approaching Confederation vessels, and absolutely stunned at the size of the force as he watched it coming through. The ships had not answered any communications, not surprising considering they were deep in hegemony territory, and at least somewhat concerned about whether it was hostile space or not. But then a signal came through from Victory. Whoever was in command of the massive force was almost certainly in the Confederation's largest and newest battleship, and Barron waited anxiously for the answer to the question eating away at his insides. Are they here to join the fight, or to arrest me? He'd been pessimistic at first. Despite his urgings, he simply could not imagine the Senate doing what he'd asked. But then he'd realized. There hadn't been time for word of his mutiny to get back to Megara, and much less for a fleet sent in response to arrive. Despite himself, he found optimism creeping in. Then the answer came back, and it was spoken by no comm officer, no sterile AIs, just a voice he knew immediately blaring through the speakers.
Admiral Barron, you old war dog, your reinforcements are here. I just hope we didn't miss the party. Clint Winters, my God, are you a sight for sore eyes. Or maybe not a sight exactly, but damn am I glad you're here.
Barron paused, but how the hell did you get those fools in the Senate to send the whole fleet?
It wasn't me, old friend. Or for that matter, Gary Holston. We were still running around in circles trying to figure out what to do when that wife of yours stepped up and made those corrupt old fools behave like a bunch of trained lapdogs.
Andy? Barron sounded surprised, but he wasn't. Not really. He'd known Andy too long for that.
What did she do? I'll tell you when I see you, my friend. It's one hell of a story. Simple as hell, and yet brilliant.
Barron just smiled. Simple but brilliant. That was Andy. Her way had always been a combination of directness and her own form of vaguely twisted genius. It was part of what he loved about her.
We can talk back on Calphron. I've already cleared the fleet's approach authorization. If it's okay with you, I'd like to shuttle over to Dauntless now. I have some things to discuss that I don't think should wait. And one thing I know shouldn't, a message from Andy for you, one you've got to see as soon as possible.
Barron wasn't sure what Andy would have to say, but any communication from her was good news as far as he was concerned.
Come on over. It'll be good to see you again in the flesh. I'm on my way, Ty. And sit down and relax for a few minutes. This may be the last time you hear this for a long while, but I've got good news for you.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Others, Blood on the Stars, Book 13. Written by Jay Allen. Performed by Jeffrey Kafer. Executive producers Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Joy Smith. Copyright 2019 by J. Allen Books, Inc. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.